thank you. Thank you for having me. Happy birthday, Michael.
Thank you.
So anyway, I'm going to be talking about work that I did.
Put that in your pocket.
Okay, can everybody hear me? Is that okay? Oh, it only matters whether you hear me. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about this project, which I worked on with student David Gossett, postdoc Abinatan Hasidim, student Andrew Ludomirsky, and Peter Shore, who we've already seen his picture today. I don't have to say who he is. And let's talk about money. We're going to be talking about using quantum mechanics to make currency. And what do we want currency or bills? What virtue do we want it to have? Well, first of all, we want it to be hard to copy. That seems to be a good a virtue. And just, I always like to show this. Here's my this dollar bill I have, which my I think shows that it looks pretty good as a dollar bill. But it's a counterfeit dollar bill, and my kid made it when he was 10 years old. So I'll show it to anybody after.
He's learning.
Yeah.
It gets better every year.
Well, it gets older. It gets more worn, yeah. There's a get-out-of-jail card that comes with it. I'll show this to anyone who wants to see it. You can see how we made it. It's a little tattered.
Did he make it from a $10 bill?
Yeah, he made it from a $10. Anyone could look at it. Anyway, I got to get him to make a new one. It got worn out. So the idea there is that the idea is that if you think of money, regular money as some kind of information, there's really nothing in the classical world that prevents you from copying information. So quantum money, we're going to see, is maybe it's harder to copy. But the thing about money that you want is you also want it to be verifiable, which means that you have some way of holding it up to the light and saying it's a good bill. And which this bill, if you look at it carefully, you'll see it's not real. But another thing which might be very nice is that if you could verify your money without asking a third party to get involved. Because, you know, suppose you're a drug dealer and you're having a transaction. You know, you want to see that it's good currency without having a consultation with the government to ask if the bills are good. You'd like to be able to be sure of it yourself. So we would like the money to have these virtues. And we're going to think of currency, then money, in this talk as bills or information stored on a computer. All right? Now, I just want to remind you of the no-cloning theorem, because that's going to be crucial here to our understanding of money. So in quantum mechanics, everything obeys the Schrodinger equation. There's never been a violation of this equation ever seen, that the time evolution of a state is given by a Hamiltonian operator acting on the state. And since all states evolve with the Schrodinger equation, this means that the state of the system at a later time is given by the state at an early time times a unitary operator that follows with the Hamiltonian intermission. But what's important here is not that this operator is unitary, but that it's linear. And of course, we know what linear means, that if you evolve one state at time zero becomes the state at time t, and another state at time zero becomes the state at time t, then if you take the superposition, you end up in that superposition. Now, using that fact, we can prove the no-cloning theorem. Well, it's going to be a very weak proof, but it'll suffice for our purposes. And the no-cloning theorem says that if you have a quantum state, an unknown quantum state, psi, and you wish to make a copy of it, that if you have an unknown quantum state psi and you wish to make a copy of it, that this is impossible. So a good quantum cloner would be an operator that takes a state psi and some blank register and replaces it with the state psi and a copy of the state psi here. In other words, psi comes in and two psis come out. But this is not a linear transformation, as you can see, because if you have a two-level system up and down and you make a transformation on up blank, you want it to go to up, and if you make the transformation on down blank, if you clone it, you want it to be down, down. this would be a good cloner. This would make two copies of up. This makes two copies of down. But acting on the linear superposition of alpha up plus beta down, you would then get alpha up up plus beta down down. But the cloner should really give this. So the linearity of quantum mechanics is the essence of the proof of the no cloning theorem, which says that this is not a possible transformation if your system obeys the Schrodinger equation. And we could talk about measurement, but measurement's not linear, but it can always be encoded in some kind of linear, in a linear point of view, as von Neumann taught us. So anyway, there's quantum no cloning, and that's promising for the idea that you should be able to build some kind of money state which cannot be copied. And in fact, the very first quantum money proposal was due to Stephen Wiesner. And this came out very early, and he recognized that there was something about quantum mechanics that could be of use information theoretically. And so in 1970, Wiesner proposed this following form for a quantum money state. You have an n-qubit product state, and that n-qubit product state, let's say, plus means spin up in the x direction, up means spin up in the z direction, this means spin down in the z direction, this means spin minus in the x direction. So the arrows are with respect to z, and the plus and minuses are with respect to x. And if you have a state like this, which goes plus, up, down, minus, etc., the no cloning theorem prevents copying of the bill. So if I said, this is the quantum money, I give it to you. You can't make a copy of it. You can't make a copy because, and of course, if you thought about measurement, if you tried to measure it, you would destroy it. Because you don't know what the quantization axes are. When we talk about this state, we're imagining that I give you this money, you don't know what these quantization axes are. And in that case, you cannot copy the bill. Now, if you sent the money back to the mint might know for each qubit if it's an eigenstate of sigma x or sigma z with the eigenvalue 1 or minus 1. So the mint, knowing that this is a plus state in the x direction, could check to see that this is actually a plus state in the x direction by measuring in the x direction and getting a plus, and could measure and see that you get a plus in the z direction and see that you get a minus in the z direction, etc. And the money would then, so the mint could check to see if it's good. So this scheme involves you taking the money and having to verify it by sending it back to the mint. So if money is sent back to the mint can verify that it's good. So there's a picture of Wiesner's money. Now the only thing that's a little bit deceptive about this picture is that these are supposed to be photons in the bill or some kind of spin states, but they don't come with the arrow telling you which direction they're pointing in. This is something you can't really see. That's just a way of depicting it by drawing a picture. All you get are a bunch of electrons. You don't really know which way they're pointing. Otherwise, we'd be giving it away. Now, what's wrong with this? We want the merchant to be able to verify the bill without sending it back to the mint. Now, you see, if the merchant knows the quantization axis and the eigenvalue of each qubit, then the merchant can verify the money. So suppose the merchant knows the first one, I can't remember anymore, was an x. The next one was a z. The next one was an x. Then the merchant could measure the money, get out the values, and but then the merchant could make a copy of the money. Because the merchant could just say, well, the first one is spin up in the x direction. The next one is spin up in the z direction. So I'm just going to make a state with those properties. So this is a simple case where the verification procedure gives you the ability to copy the money. So the tension here is between the verification algorithm and the inability to copy. So what we seek is a verification procedure which allows you to verify the money, but which doesn't give away so much about it that you can, in fact, copy the money. Okay, am I making sense? Any questions about this? Okay, great. All right, so we'll go on to the next thing. So what would we like quantum money to look like? Well, we would like quantum money, oops, sorry. So we would like each built have a serial number, P, which is a classical thing, and an associated quantum state, dollar sign P. And we would like the mint to be able to produce pairs, which have a serial number and a quantum state. And a merchant would be handed a bill, and he or she should be able to run a verification algorithm on the quantum part that outputs good money but leaves it undamaged. We don't want the verification procedure to damage the money. But given the serial number and the quantum state, we want it hard to make two states, psi and psi prime, each of which pass the verification algorithm. If something passes the that counterfeit money here means something that passes the verification. Okay? Yeah. Oh, was that a question? No? Okay. So let me help to set up what we call a blueprint for quantum money, and then I'm going to tell you how we try to realize this. So in the blueprint, we start with some big set, like the integers from 1 to 2 to the n, where n is 1,000. And so the size of B of the number of elements in B is like 2 to the n. It's 2 to the n. It's a very big set. And then we're going to imagine we have a function, which is many to 1. And so it acts on B, and its range, where it goes is called the range, right? And this is much smaller, but still big than B. So the size of the target is big, say 2 to the n over 2. And for each element in the target space, the inverse image of that element is also a big set. So many things map each target value, F should be easy to compute. So we're going to start, imagine we have some function like that. It's easy to imagine a function like that. And so the mint is first going to make a state, which is the uniform superposition over all things in the set B. It's very easy to make these kind of uniform superpositions. And there's going to be a second register. And what the mint then is compute F into the second register. So the mint has a quantum computer. F is an easy to compute function. And the mint computes F into the second register. But since the mint has a quantum computer, this can be done in parallel. It can be done on the superposition in one shot. You compute the value of F on every input. So this takes no more time than it takes to do one computation. Then what the mint does is it measures the second register and call the observed value P. So now the state is this. It's the sum on all Bs such that F of B is P. And we're going to think of P as the serial number. And so our money is going to result from this kind of procedure. And this kind of procedure doesn't allow the mint to choose the serial number. The serial number will just be whatever comes out. So this money will have the feature that the mint cannot produce two bills with the same serial number, because it's incredibly unlikely that you get two values of P. Okay? So now I want to talk more specifically about what we do using knots. So to do that, and because the reason I'm giving this talk is because this allows me to introduce some topology here. So we're going to have a fast review of knot theory, or the relevant parts of knot theory for this discussion. So a knot is a loop of string in three dimensions, that it's a map from S1 into R3. And a link is a bunch of intertwined knots. And a link diagram, if you think of a knot as something in three dimensions, usually, though, we want to have some representation of it, which is two-dimensional. It's very convenient to have a two-dimensional representation. So you can pick a plane, and you can project the knot into the plane. And when you do that, you would like to you get a picture, which we call a link diagram. So this thing kind of looks three-dimensional, but think of it as really in the plane. And what's important here is that there are clearly places where strands go over other strands, and that's indicated by the breaks. So so this picture represents the knot. Now, two links are called said to be equivalent if one can be smoothly morphed into the other without cutting the string. We don't need a notion any more sophisticated than what you imagine in your head it means to smoothly deform something without cutting it. Just the most elementary ideas of that suffice for this discussion. Okay? Now, two links are equivalent. This is now sort of interesting. Two links are equivalent if and only if the associated diagrams can be transformed into each other using a sequence of moves. So I want to go over this because this is a theorem which has some content. If you imagine you have two little pieces of string depicted in the plane here, and you drag the green one under the red one like that, you don't change the isomorphism class of the link. I think that's pretty clear. All you're doing is pulling a piece under another. You're not is invariant under any kind of topological deformation. The other thing you can do is introduce a little twist like that. That also keeps you in the isomorphism class. Another thing you can do is you have this red strand and the black strand, and you can bring the green one up underneath. And this set of moves are called Rademeister moves. And it turns out that I think it's clear that if you make these moves, you don't change the equivalence class of the link. But what's also true is that if two links are equivalent, there is a sequence of Rademeister moves that brings one to the other. And that's, I guess, much less obvious, but that happens to be true. There is a sequence. It could be very long, though, but there is a sequence which brings one to the other, a finite sequence. Okay? So if you start with something like this, which is called the unknot, that's just the circle, well, you can make a little twist in it and put another twist, then I could start schlepping these around and make a big mess out of it. And I could take something which is kind of simple looking and make it very complicated looking. And so given two link diagrams, there is no known procedure for determining if the associated links are equivalent. So that's No polynomial procedure, that's right. This problem is, it's actually, yeah, that's right. I think it's only known that this is decidable, right? It's not even known, though, there's no known polynomial procedure, but it's not even known that there's a short witness. It's worse than, right, it's not even known that this problem is not known to be an NP. Because it's not even known that there's no known short witness for showing that two links are equivalent. So, it's only known that this is decidable, but it's not known if it's an NP.
Decidable with some stack of exponentials, right?
Yeah.
How many?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, but it's there is a bound, but it's not polynomial, right? That's all I mean. So that means that there's no. I mean, the witness could be of another nature, but the obvious witness would be the actual set of moves, but there is no such witness. It's not known whether. Okay, so the security of our money is actually going to be based upon the fact that, well, not the fact the, well, I guess the fact that no, it is the fact that people believe that this is difficult. I could call that a fact.
So reducibility. It's called reducibility to a problem we don't know.
Right, that's the point here, yeah. And many security procedures are based on that, and that's what we're doing here. Okay, so, well, we are going to, though, take advantage of a not invariant. There are functions of link diagrams which are invariant under Rademeister moves. And the simplest example of that, which, well, I'm not going to explain what it is, called the Alexander polynomial. It's also the first example of a link invariant. And it's called a polynomial, but that's a little bit misleading. It is a polynomial, but we're not going to think of evaluating it anywhere. I mean, what we're going to really think of it is just the list of coefficients which make up the polynomial. We're not interested in the value of the Alexander polynomial at an input. We're only interested in the Alexander polynomial itself, which just means the list of coefficients which make the polynomial. Okay, so the list of coefficients P is what we mean by the polynomial. So P, I'm going to write, is the Alexander polynomial of a link diagram. And this can be quickly computed in polynomial time. If I give you a link diagram, you can compute the Alexander polynomial quickly. Now, two links coming from two equivalent knots have the same Alexander polynomial. And that's because you can show that the Alexander polynomial is invariant under the Rademeister moves. So since it's invariant under the Rademeister moves, and we've already established that two, or asserted, I didn't establish, excuse me, I've already asserted that if two links are equivalent, one can be obtained from the other by a sequence of Rademeister moves, means the Alexander polynomials are the same. So two links coming from two equivalent knots have the same Alexander polynomial, but the converse is not true. There are inequivalent knots with the same, or inequivalent links, with the same value of the Alexander polynomial. Otherwise, you could use the Alexander polynomial to solve not isomorphism. You would just measure the, compute the Alexander polynomial, and if two were different, you'd say those knots are, in fact, inequivalent. That's just not true. Okay? Just... I'm sorry? Say again?
If they were the same, you would assert incorrectly, perhaps, that they were.
Yeah, which is not fair. I guess you could determine the two knots are inequivalent if they have different Alexander polynomials, okay? So, now, well, this is a little bit less, I just want to go through this. We're working on in a finite dimensional Hilbert space, so we need some discrete way of representing the link diagram so we can code them as bit strings, because we want to have any quantum device, we want it to have finite resources, and I don't want to be drawing these pictures in three dimensions. So in some sense, all I really need is to say that we can pixelate this thing and represent it with a finite amount of information. And one of the convenient ways to do that is actually to redraw these things on grids. And this is a grid diagram. And this is actually for an oriented link, where the arrows go in a particular direction. But the only real takeaway message here is that there's a way I can make a grid, and I can put like O's and X's in it, and I can represent a two-dimensional link diagram on a grid by a very definite set of rules. So this allows you to imagine a discrete and finite representation of a link diagram. It's polynomial in the number of vertices. It's not much, I don't think it's much bigger than the number of vertices by the number of vertices. It's about that big. Is that right, Peter? It's about that big. Of the grid. It's about the number of vertices by the number of vertices, right?
Something like that.
Yeah. It's about that big. Okay. So grid diagrams are discrete representations of links. Rademeister moves can then be formulated as grid moves. But the reason I'm getting into this is because we have to be concrete in our scheme. We have to say exactly what we're doing. So grid moves, Rademeister moves can be formulated as grid moves. What gets a little tricky here is that Rademeister moves can change the number of crossings. So grid moves can also change the dimension of the grid. Oh, I guess that helps answer my question. It also can change by the if you increase the number of crossings. Sorry, I should have said that.
No,
I said something wrong then. You're right. Thank you. It really depends on the number of crossings more than on the number of things. Thank you. I said something wrong. Yeah, now I realized it. Okay, right. Depends on the number of crossings. So grid moves can change the dimension of the grid. So I would like to think of P S of G as G prime. So this is I call P of S of G, it's a permutation, really. Well, if I change the dimension, I guess it's a permutation if you embed the whole thing in a much larger thing. So, but this is an operation which takes a grid diagram to another grid diagram, and there's a finite list of grid moves. So I have now a discrete representation of the grid of the links as grids, and I have a finite list of moves which take each grid diagram to another. They may change the dimension. But you could imagine that if you applied a sequence of randomly picked grid moves, you would end up with some kind of random grid diagrams equivalent to an initial diagram. So now let's go to quantum money from knots. So we're going to start with an initial state, which is the superposition over all grid diagrams. Now, there's a little detail here. I need to cut this off because I don't want grid diagrams which are too big. So we have a smooth cutoff, rho of g, which smooths it out. So rho of g is a weight, which depends on the dimension of g. The number of grid diagrams of dimension d grows like d factorial squared. So we want to cut this off because we don't want to have infinite resources. So we have to introduce a cutoff, and we figured out how to do that successfully. So I think we should just think of the cutoff as a nuisance for this description, but I think you should not worry that we're unaware of it. So I'm trying to reassure you that we know we have to cut it off and we know how to do it in a smooth way that allows what I say to be correct. So what we're going to do is start with the uniform superposition over all grid diagrams, and then we're going to compute the Alexander polynomial into the next register. And we're going to measure the second register and get the result P, which is the Alexander polynomial. So we're going to use the Alexander polynomial as the function. This is a huge set of things, and we're going to measure the Alexander polynomial. So the money state is going to look like the sum of all grid diagrams such that the Alexander polynomial of the grid diagram is P, the serial number. This is a massive sum over grid diagrams with the same Alexander polynomial. Now, let's talk about the merchant verification. Recall that for each grid move, I can take a grid diagram to another grid diagram. This is invertible because those grid diagrams, this is one-to-one, this is really a permutation. And so I can turn this into a quantum operator, which takes there's some basis of grid diagrams. There's a Hilbert space whose basis elements are grid diagrams. And I can take this ket to this ket g prime. This is a good invertible quantum operator. And for simplicity from now on, let's just take that function rho to be 1, because otherwise it gets too annoying. So the quantum money is now the superposition over all grid diagrams. I got rid of the normalization factor, because without the cutoff, this is an infinite sum. But we're not going to worry about that. Now, what's important to note here is that if you take this sum over all grid diagrams with a certain value of the Alexander polynomial and you make a grid move on it, it's invariant. Okay? If you would like to think of something else, you know, think of a system, let's say, if you have a lattice and it's an infinite lattice, and you say, what states are translationally invariant? Well, the only state that's actually translationally invariant without a phase is the state where you have equal amplitude on every site. Because if you move it, you still have equal amplitude. So this thing, which has equal amplitude on every grid diagram with the same value of the Alexander polynomial, is invariant under the one-to-one grid moves because everybody goes somewhere. And so that's the basis of what we're going to use as verification. So, I'm not good at this. Okay. So the money is invariant under all the grid moves. This is because it contains all grid diagrams with the Alexander polynomial of the grid diagram equal to P. So the merchant verifies the quantum state by checking that it's invariant under all the grid moves. Now, this can actually be done quantum mechanically. You can actually check all the grid moves, but I only have like 2 minutes left, so I'm going to be very fast on this page. The point is that you can define an operator, which is this operator, which involves the sum of every possible, all the quantum operators associated with the grid moves, and it turns out that the money state appended with an extra register, which is this sum here, is an eigenstate of this state, the green with the green underneath, happens to be an eigenstate of V with eigenvalue 1. So there's just a little bit of very elementary math to check that V acting on this is the same state. So that means that if we present you with the money and you measure this state, this operator on the state, you better get back a 1. Otherwise, and if you do get back a 1, and hold on 1 second. Suppose the money is perfect. If the money is perfect, you'll get back a 1, and the money will come back undamaged. And so,
the money will be transformed by the ket, but it's benign because it shares the Alexander polynomial with the original money. Did I get that wrong? Is that not right?
But
it's not quite the same money.
No, I've just not. The Alexander polynomial. I'm sorry. Where does the Alexander polynomial change?
It didn't.
It didn't. Right.
That's the point. The point is, the moves, though, transform the quantum part of the state.
No, but the state's invariant because it just shifted around. Yeah.
So it's as good as it was before.
Right.
And its serial number hasn't changed anything else, but the sequence of cats that make up the state of that money has been benignly perturbed.
No, it's the same thing as if I have a translationally invariant state and I translate it, it's the same state. No, it's invariant.
I know that.
So invariant means that when I act with the operator. Yeah, the state's the sum over everything. Right, the state is the sum over everything, and each of those operations maybe takes one element and pushes it elsewhere, but the infinite sum, in this case, this massive sum is still the massive sum. Oh, it's finite because we cut it off.
It damages it by a little bit because of the finite cutoff.
Right, it damages it a little bit because of the finite cutoff, and that's because it damages a little bit because of the finite cutoff. That's why we need the cutoff. The cutoff is a little nuisance which we need to deal with. That's right. It does damage a little bit because of the finite cutoff.
Mm-hmm. So how does the merchant determine that you have 10 base value of your quantum money?
I'm sorry?
Where do you get the base value of your quantum money?
You mean like whether it's $5 or $10?
Yeah.
Well, because the bill, I give you a bill, it says $5 on it, it says the serial number, and it has the quantum state. Okay, so it says it in the classical information. The serial number is classical, and you could have other classical information on the money, like what's its denomination.
So maybe it's worth saying that we have a trick to handle all that stuff, which is that you have just a classical digital signature, right? Which would say, yes, indeed, this comes from the bank. Indeed, it's worth $10 and nothing else. And then the only thing the quantum part has to do is make sure that, like, it's uncopyable.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. You see, so.
But then the industry becomes changing the value, counterfeiting the value.
Well, no.
The whole point that there's a digital signature.
Well, simpler than a digital signature would be the following. Okay, so, but I think it's just easier to have a list. But let me explain the list first, and then we can talk about the digital signature. Right. There's an alternative to what Scott said, which is a little simpler to say, but it's not as, or maybe it's more cumbersome in a certain way. It depends on how you view it.
With a quantum computer, it's nothing.
Yeah, compared to the fact that you need a whole tank of refrigerators coming into your, with each bill in your wallet. All these other considerations are secondary, right?
Yeah.
So the mint, in our money scheme, the mint could produce pairs P, dollar sign P. Each serial number is different. That's because the mint cannot in advance determine what the serial numbers are going to be. So what that means is a rogue mint cannot produce the same serial numbers. You see, when you give the scheme for making quantum money, I'm also giving you the ability to make this quantum money by the same method. So you could set up a rogue mint. So if you set up a rogue mint, you could start to make money. Now, but the thing is that the serial numbers you produce could never be the same as the serial numbers the original mint produced. So the original mint has to, one thing the mint can do, there's an alternative, which is a digital signature, but one thing the mint can do is produce a list of valid serial numbers and put that on a CD. So you're a merchant, and when you get your verification quantum computer, you also get a CD, which tells you the serial numbers of the valid money. So if I give you a bill, you first check that the serial number comes from the mint that produced the money, and so that rogue mint cannot produce money with the same serial number.
Unless the rogue mint also produces rogue CDs, which they...
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. That's why a digital signature might be good, yeah. Right. If the rogue mint produced rogue CDs, that I cannot stop. That's like chopping... It's hard to stop the South Koreans. I mean, the North Koreans from counterfeiting American money. Because I guess if you set up a rogue mint and you set up a rogue operation... For producing CDs, I guess
Well, wait a second. We have HTTPS or something.
Right, right. No, I mean with a digital.
Which is digital signature.
Also, you got to trust the certificate authority.
Yeah.
But at least it centralizes the trust into the.
Right, but that's either good or it centralizes the trust. The question: do we want that? You know, the drug dealer may not want to contact the central authority.
Have not just the serial number, but the value, right? That's the
Yeah, I mean, with the serial number would come the denomination. Yeah, I think listing the denomination is like the easy part. So each serial number is different. A rogue mint cannot produce the same serial numbers. Tendered money can be verified. We do not know how to counterfeit bills. And our security is based on the inability to tell if two link diagrams represent equivalent lengths. And there's a picture of the quantum money. Now you understand the diagram. That's the best part of the talk. Okay.
Maybe just one quick question.
Really dumb question. The last point, we don't know how to counterfeit bills.
Yeah.
So if I came up with an algorithm that, given a serial number, could produce a quantum superposition of all the knots with leaves and balance.
Right, that would be good enough.
That would be good enough.
Right. So, yes, and that's...
Do you believe that such a thing doesn't exist?
Well, if you give me a minute, let me discuss a simpler problem. Where such a thing, no one knows how to do that. The simple problem I would like to talk about is called graph isomorphism. Well, maybe it's not simpler. It depends on how you view it. But I shouldn't have said. Let me consider a different problem, because simpler might be in the is a subjective term. So let's consider a different problem, graph isomorphism. And graph isomorphism is the problem of, given two graphs, figuring out whether there's a permutation of the vertices of one that gives you another. That problem, there is no classical algorithm that solves that in polynomial time in the number of vertices. Okay? Now, except typically it does, but there's no...
None that's proved to. There are ones that exist that might do it.
Exactly. There are ones that exist. That's right. Okay, fair enough. Which of course, that's right. What Scott said is right. There are heuristic algorithms which will work, but there's no provable algorithm. So let's assume it's a difficult problem, but let me present for you the quantum solution, which is kind of clever and relevant to this. The quantum solution would be, suppose I could take a graph and I could produce the quantum state, which is the uniform superposition of all permutations of the graph. Suppose I could do that. Now I take a graph and I take another graph. Suppose they're isomorphic. Then those two uniform superpositions are the same because they each contain all permutations of the graphs, and they're 100% the same. But if the graphs are not isomorphic, then there's no overlaps in those sets. So the two states are orthogonal. So the quantum solution to graph isomorphism would be the ability to take a graph and produce the uniform superposition over all permutations of it. Now, that has been known for a long time, and people have been looking for a long time for a way to produce that state, and no one has figured out how to do it. And we think that this problem maybe is harder. It has a little bit different structure, but this is even harder to produce that uniform superposition. But if you could do that, well, first you could see whether you could solve graph isomorphism. That would be a big deal in the quantum computing community. But you could also see if you could solve this. Does that help a little bit? Okay.
Let's thank Eddie again.
Okay, thanks.